This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Melissa Leo, won the Best Supporting Actress Award this week from the New York Film Critics Circle for her performance in the new film, The Fighter, which opens wide tomorrow. That performance also received a Golden Globe nomination this week. Leo received an Oscar nomination for her starring role in the 2008 film Frozen River as a mother who turns to smuggling immigrants across the Canadian border to support her two children. In the 90s, she co-starred as a detective on the NBC series Homicide. She's now shooting the second season of the HBO series Tremé. Her new film, The Fighter, is based on a true story about two boxers who are brothers. Melissa Leo plays their mother and manager. She's tough, crass, and small-time, but she has big ambitions for her sons. When the older son becomes a crack addict, she focuses on getting fights for her younger son, played by Mark Wahlberg. But it's sometimes the wrong fights, ones he can't win. Wahlberg's girlfriend, played by Amy Adams, thinks he shouldn't let his mother manage him anymore. In this scene, after Wahlberg took a beating in the ring, Melissa Leo and her seven mean-looking daughters pay an unexpected visit to Wahlberg and his girlfriend.
Hi.
Well, 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 look at this.
Look at what?
Why are you hiding from us, Mickey?
He's not hiding.
I wasn't talking to you. I was talking to my son. What are you doing next to, huh?
I'm right here. I ain't hiding from nobody else.
What are you gonna do? Turn your back on Dickie next, huh? All we ever wanted for you was to be world champion.
Mickey's a grown man. He can think for himself.
Shut your mouth.
Skank.
Don't call me skank. I'll rip that nasty hair right out of your head.
I'm his mother. And his manager.
You're not my manager anymore. And I'm not waiting for Dickie, okay? I'm not getting any younger.
Who's gonna look after you, sweetheart? I mean, come on. I know you don't understand it, but I had 9 kids. And I love every one of you the same.
You got a funny way of showing it, letting him get beat up, letting him get his hand broken.
You're crazy.
Boss! Mickey is my
baby! What did I just say to you?
I love that scene. Melissa Leo, welcome to Fresh Air. And congratulations on your nomination for a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress and on winning the New York Film Critics Circle Best Supporting Actress Award. Good for you.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And now I get to be here talking to you. So,
Would you describe how you look in this film?
Well, I'm not very recognizable. I show up at lots of parties after the film has been screened. And nobody has any idea who I am in the room. She does not look like me. She looks like Alice Ward. She has a very stylish hairdo, very short, very white blonde, very teased and hairsprayed, and some fabulous costumes provided by Mark Bridges, who actually had the family albums, as did the whole production company, to make reference for Alice and the family during the years that our film takes place.
And you look so tough and hardened. Even the way you smoke your cigarettes, it's like you are puffing on them so hard. You are attacking those cigarettes. Everything in you is just like, it's so aggressive. Even like, there's something aggressive about your hair even. I mean, I can't explain it, but...
Yes, I see what you're saying, and I really think that, you know, having walked in Alice's shoes, she's actually a very gentle and loving lady. Do you know? But she saw an opportunity for her boys and rose above whatever she felt she might be inside of herself and made careers for the two of them. Now, the fight game is an ugly game, and I don't mean what happens in the ring. The management, the horror stories of fighters being duped by their own management, stolen from, put in life-threatening situations by their own people. It's just an extraordinarily nasty game, and I think if Alice has a little rough about her and a little aggressive about her, I think that it's something she's had to learn. Or how could she have gotten Dick in the ring with Sugar Ray? How could she have begun Mickey's career?
How did you get the part of the mother in The Fighter?
Well, ordinarily I'll get a script first and sort of begin my decision making, off the page. For The Fighter, I had been told that David O. Russell wanted to see me. I found out later that Mark Wahlberg was very interested in me playing Alice Ward. And so David and I met. And I have to say, within about 5 minutes of meeting David, it was as if the part was mine already. He believed I was his Alice, believed in me so greatly that I found myself believing that with him and forgetting my very desperate and important question about, aren't I too young to play Mark and Christian's mother? And on we went, and off to the costume shop and the hair department and all the rest of it.
Too young? I hadn't thought of that. How old are they compared to you?
I don't know. There's not 10 years between us, I'll tell you that.
Wow. So what did you do to compensate for that?
I remember it being an enormous hesitation on my part to begin with. And I remember that at some point I saw that that question had sort of vanished. And just plowed on ahead, I guess, and believed myself to be their parent and the parent of the 7 other girls as well. And that's probably the biggest secret of acting. If the actor believes it themselves, I can make you believe it.
There's a scene in The Fighter after you've caught your son, who's played by Christian Bale. You've caught him at the crack house. You're trying to drag him back to your home. So you're driving him back. You're really angry with him and basically not talking with him. And then to try to win you over, he starts singing the Bee Gees song, I Started a Joke. And you eventually just kind of like warm up and you start singing along with him. Now, I have no idea whether that's a story that you or the screenwriter was actually told by a member of the family, or whether that song was arbitrarily chosen. So I'm wondering if there's any backstory for that scene.
Yeah, it's a scene that's very dear and precious to me. We almost didn't shoot it. We shot it with very little light left in the day, and it's an exterior scene in the car there. You have to have God's light. God's light goes down at a certain time, whether we want it to or not. And it was really looking like it was getting squoze out, and the producers were kind of relieved because David really wanted that particular song, which might turn out to be rather expensive, and if they didn't shoot it, they wouldn't have to worry about it. And I said, you can't not shoot this. I've been sitting here for 5 hours waiting to shoot this, what I think is a very important scene. It's important because it says so much about the relationship between Dick and Alice, which is an important element in the story, where you're dealing with not only this exciting boxing triumph in the end, but you're also dealing with a very complicated family that both, as much as they might be detrimental to each other along the way, really can't live without one another. And I love that you spot that scene in the film. I love that it ends up being in the film. And I, not being a singer, loved having a duet with Christian Bale.
So how did David O. Russell choose that song? Why that one?
That is something you would have to ask Mr. O. Russell. All I knew was that it was ideal perfect. Like, why wonder? It was just so perfect. Why? How could you have thought of anything else? What a perfect song to sing right then, right there, and tell a story of a many, many years of history, and many times the song might have been sung before in jollier moments. There's just so much there and such irony in the lyric of that song.
Yeah, and you know that means that they have their duets and they have their in-jokes, and he's just trying to kind of get back on that track with her.
And that she still sees, crack addict or not, she knows who that boy is, and she loves him. She's really mad that he lied to her.
No,
but she's not making judgment about him.
You have great scenes with Christian Bale and great scenes with Mark Wahlberg. Do they both approach acting differently and get into character differently?
Well, I think that it's fairly obvious that Christian goes in a very deep method type way into his character. I met him the day he was meeting Dick Eklund for the first time, and I actually watched this process of Christian morphing into this other man that he plays in the film. Mark comes with the 4 years of training and getting his body in the right shape and his boxing abilities in the right shape to be able to really sell the fighting in the movie the way that he does. But it doesn't come with a set of ideas of how the scene might play. Because I am this person, this is how I might do this. It's this sort of question that Christian might ask himself going into it. Now, that's an assumption on my part. I don't know the inner workings of Christian. It's just then Mark shows up and on a dime can offer you the same moment in the film with laughter, with fear, with hatred, with regret, with anything that David Russell asks in a single take, and Mark delivers. It's an extraordinary thing to watch. When you have an actor like Christian and you want to adjust the performance, you got to work a little harder because he's already done all this other work that you have to rework to get the, right? So it's two very, very different ways of acting that really suited the characters that they were playing and my relationship to them then.
So what's the difference for you as an actress working against each of them?
The easiest way for me to describe it, Alice's Dickie was right there. And Alice's Mick, she had to reach for.
So Dickie's Christian Bale and Mick is Mark Wahlberg. So you had to reach for the Mark Wahlberg performance or for...
Alice has to work harder to communicate with Mickey. And communication with Dick just happens.
Well, but that makes sense because you're on the same wavelength with Dickie a lot. And Mark Wahlberg's really alienated from you. He wants to get away from you. He thinks you've
exactly.
been hurting him. So that...
Exactly. So in fact, the acting techniques of each of them aided my performance because of exactly that.
2 years ago, you were nominated for an Oscar for your performance, your leading performance in the independent film Frozen River, in which you played a woman trying to raise a couple of kids on her salary from a part-time job at a dollar store. Your husband is a gambling man who's run off with the money that you'd save for a new double-wide trailer home. The home that you and your family do have is falling apart. So to get some income, you team up with a Native American woman who had stolen your car, and together you smuggle immigrants across the Canadian border to the U.S., and that requires driving over the frozen river that the movie is named after. Let me play a scene here. In this scene, you're confronting your son about damage he's done to the house while trying to repair frozen pipes with his father's blowtorch. You'd warned him against using that blowtorch, and he's damaged what's left of the home. So here's the scene.
What do you want? Something happened to Dad?
No.
What do you want?
Did you have a fire here last night?
The pipes froze, so I fixed them.
You fixed them?
Yeah.
Did you use the blowtorch?
Dad did it before.
So you used the blowtorch! Oh, look at this! We can't live here anymore!
So what? It's just a tin crapper.
No, this was our house!
So we're getting a new one, right?
That's it!
No.
Damn it!
What are you...
Son of a... Don't touch it!
It's Melissa Leo in a scene from Frozen River. Well, I think it's great that you started really getting the accolades you deserve in, I guess, your late 40s, at a time when a lot of actresses are considered to have already reached their expiration date, which is so unfair.
Exactly right. Exactly, totally right. And it is with great pleasure that I share this recognition, that I shared the recognition about Frozen River with all of those women. I know many of them. I know many of them, and they are fine, fine actresses that maybe they weren't even ousted out of the business, but their hearts and bodies, souls couldn't take it anymore. The kind of like, oh, yeah, no, sort of, you won't. You know, it just is such a judgment placed. And you know, I it makes me then think of the relationships I had with both of my parents' mothers. And it was their age and their wisdom and what they had seen in life and what they had been through and things you couldn't do in a couple of years. You could only do in 60, 70, 80, 90 years. It's a very important part of living, getting older, anti-aging. Pah!
One of the things I really appreciate about your acting is that you're not vain about looking older. As far as I can tell, you haven't done Botox or plastic surgery, and I think a lot of actresses, once they turn 40 or even younger, are starting to get work done. So this is one of the reasons why I love watching you, because I feel like I'm watching a real face that shows signs of some age, like a real face. Are there pressures in the industry to get work done when you're an actress?
I have not encountered that. I was blessed with a mother who refused to raise a vain daughter, and it's really assisted me in my acting career. I don't really think so much about how pretty or how sexy the character is unless it's applicable to what she's got going on in her life.
Now, you're very good at playing tough women. Whether, you know, it's like the mother in Frozen River who is taking a lot of risks and being really tough in order to raise money for her family and for a home. Or, you know, in The Tough Mother in The Fighter, or going back to Homicide, where a lot of people first became aware of you, where you played a detective, like the only...
She was a whole other kind of tough mother.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Did you ever play the ingenue? Were you ever in a teen comedy or anything like that?
No, I was not in a teen comedy. I don't know that I have a rom-com to my credit.
Which means romantic comedy for anybody who doesn't know the the contraction.
I was nominated for Daytime Emmy in the ingenue category. In 1980-something or other.
Is this for All My Children?
For All My Children.
And your hair, which is so often long and red, did you have long red hair when you were a teenager?
Yes, pretty much. I've had that head of hair that has preceded much of me through much of my career.
Was red hair a good thing or a bad thing when you were growing up? Some kids get teased for it.
I had so little contact with other children when I was little that I don't really know. They might have had an issue with it. If they did, I didn't notice. As I got, you know, there was one opportunity many years ago that I dyed it brunette. And that experience taught me something about myself that I would not have learned without dyeing my hair brown, which is that people judge. As a brown-haired woman, I walked out of the hotel in Rhode Island and people looked me in the eye and greeted me, "Good morning." And for me, that was astonishing. It had never happened in my redheaded life.
Why not?
Because people judge a book by its color. And if I wasn't sure, by the time I'd done these two blondes of Lois Riley and Alice Ward and walked in the world, not just in costume, but, you know, on off days as a blonde, people not only look you in the eye and say good morning, men and women both come up and touch you and ask you very intimately, how are you today?
Wait, so
a redhead, yeah, on the other hand, is someone who will steal your husband, has a fiery temper, and people tend to cross the street when they see a redhead coming.
Okay. So you said when you were growing up you had little contact with other children. How come?
Oh, poor me. I was a shy, introverted, awkward child. I had my older brother and two boys next door. That's who I remember for the first 10 years of my life. And then I had a hard time making friends. But when I started to, I make a friend for life. I've got a half a dozen women I've collected over the years who are very close, dear friends. But I still remain a little awkward amongst people, if you must know. I like the world of pretend much more than the real one outside. And as far back as I can remember, 2-3 years old, I felt the same way.
Does having acted a long time and having gotten acclaim for your acting given you a degree of self-confidence and comfort that makes it more comfortable to be yourself?
Absolutely. That's absolutely what's happened. You're a very, very smart lady to see and know that. And the recognition a couple of years ago by the Academy, this by the extremely fussy Hollywood foreign press with the Golden Globe. The New York critics, my God, aren't they the fussiest ones in the country, recognizing me? It's quite remarkable. And I am happy to say, take it in. And feel extreme gratitude and a little sense of pride.
So as we speak, you've been in the middle of shooting Tremé, the series set in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, following characters dealing with going on with life after the floods. And you're shooting the second season, which will be shown in the spring. In the show, you play a civil liberties lawyer, and you're dealing with several people who have lost things or have been lost or missing because of the flood. And you're dealing with police issues and stuff. And your husband, who is played by John Goodman, is a professor who has gotten very caught up in the idea that the disaster part of the hurricane was really caused by man-made problems, by bad levees, by a bad response to the flood. And he's become absolutely obsessive about this, and it's led him to become paranoid. And he's kind of not in a good place. At the end of the season, he kills himself. At what point did you know that that was going to happen?
I actually was lucky enough to know all along we would just have John for a year. The more I worked with him, the sadder that made me feel. He is a joy to work with. And I am grateful, too, that it wasn't shocking to me. Like most of Tony Burnett's life, I have episode 4 for season 2 right here in my bag with me. Anxiously, when I finish talking with you, I'm going to crack it open and read it and find out what's happening next with her and what's she thinking and what's she doing. Because by and large, we really truly don't know. That particular thing I did know, and I have to say in retrospect, I'm very glad I did know, because it was devastating to me. And I spent the whole summer, like I think much of the country that watched Treme, thinking, well, maybe he'll come back, though. But maybe he could come back. And maybe he wasn't really dead, and he'll be there. And I found myself sort of in that position. But there we are down there shooting again, and Mr. Goodman is not with us, I'm sorry to say. He lives down there and stops by the set from time to time, which is great.
So so this is a contractual thing that John Goodman was willing to be there for a year.
I don't know if where the contract began. That I don't know.
Right.
But what I do know is that there was a story that David Simon and that amazing bunch of writers wanted very much to tell. There was a man who did come to enormous renown post-Katrina when YouTube was very, very young. With, I don't know if I can say it on your radio, but his tagline is the same as Creighton's. F-U-U effing Fs, I'll say, on the radio. And that's not what he said on YouTube. And that man did, for whatever his own reasons were and own, you know, history and so on, kill himself at some point shortly after Katrina. And that was a story that they wanted to tell. So whether it was, as things tend to be in my business, you know, sort of contractual and, oh, why'd you use that person for the part? Well, that's who got us the money. I think that John's limited stay was actually more carefully designed than that. I work for some very, very smart people down there.
So after you left Homicide, which is the first series that you did with David Simon, the creator of Treme, What kind of work did you get afterwards?
Well, here's the ugly truth about that. I was fired from Homicide. I really needed the job. I had a small son and a fair amount of rather public strife going on at that time. I really needed the job, and they let me go, whether it was because I was having such a hard time personally or whatever. I shall never actually know. But It was a hard job to lose, and it was even harder once I got home, and I could not get hired to save my life. I had been working by then for more than 10 years, closer to 15, and I wasn't even getting auditions. And the scuttlebutt I began to hear, of course nobody ever says it to your face, had to do with, well, we don't want that. I had gone for the last 3 years of Homicide without any makeup on. It seemed to me a reasonable thing to do. I was working with male actors who weren't using any makeup. We were all playing police detectives. Why did I have to put makeup on? Aren't there women in the world, like myself, that don't wear makeup when they go out every day? Can we show that on national television? That might have had to do with why I was eventually fired from the job. But as I say, I'll never know. And very, very hard. There was something about the way Kay Howard landed with people, that there was a truth in her that made producers and so on feel that was me. And you know, they didn't want to see that again or something like that. Eventually, it was really not until 21 Grams came around that there seemed to be an actual career afoot again.
Well, the fact that you had such a hard time after Homicide makes it all the more sweeter that you're getting such recognition now. Congratulations on all the recognition that you're getting now. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. A joy to talk to you.
Melissa Leo won the New York Film Critics Circle Award this week for Best Supporting Actress for her performance in the new film The Fighter, which opens wide tomorrow. She's now shooting season 2 of Tremé. Here's the theme. For decades, Las Vegas was the only place in the United States where casino gambling was legal. Atlantic City legalized gambling in the late 70s, and since then, more and more states and local governments have gotten into the game, lured by the promise of new jobs and tax revenues. 40 states now permit some form of casino gambling. We wondered how the rush to gaming has worked out for the state and local governments that embraced it, especially since so many states are suffering serious budget crises these days. We turned to Richard McGowan, an economics professor at Boston College, who studied and written about gambling for years. McGowan is also a Jesuit priest. His latest book is called The Gambling Debate. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Richard McGowan, welcome to Fresh Air. It's been widely reported, of course, that states and local governments are in fiscal trouble with the recession and the decline of tax revenues and pension funds that are stressed by weak investment portfolios. Are more state and local governments turning to expanded gambling now as a source of new revenue?
Well, Ohio just approved it in the last election. They usually use the gambling revenue not so much for the support. It's usually used for a very specific purpose. So, for instance, in the state of Pennsylvania, the slot machines and the casino gambling is used to help support elderly pay property taxes. And in other states, it's used for education purposes. For instance, in Georgia, the lottery proceeds go to support college students in paying tuition. Gambling is always associated with a good cause, and that's how you get the bill through. In other words, the good cause in Pennsylvania was the elderly. In New Jersey, it's the same thing. In Massachusetts, the lottery supports local towns and cities, so it's the good cause that it's used for. So it's not usually just used for general revenue purposes.
Okay. Now, in any place where there's a debate about whether gambling will be legalized in an area, the boosters will claim that jobs are created, economic activity will be generated, which you wouldn't otherwise see in the region. And then, of course, after it comes, we see statistics affirming that indeed jobs have been created and new economic activity has been generated. To what extent are these statistics and claims reliable?
Well, you do create jobs when you open up a casino. But the casino is a form of entertainment. So has the casino then cannibalized other forms of entertainment? And that's very tough to get statistically down. In other words, for instance, if you open up a casino and it has a restaurant in it, will the restaurants in the area be negatively affected because now people will go to the casino and go to the restaurant in the casino? Will people go to movies less because they can go to the casino and rather than go to a movie or other forms of entertainment? So I would probably say it's sometimes just a wash. In other words, people will shift their entertainment funds from one form of entertainment to another.
Now, I wonder if there's not another effect. One of the things you see about gambling is that it's far more heavily taxed than other forms of entertainment, like bowling or movies. Does that have the effect of transferring some income from the pockets of consumers and from local areas to state government if people are now spending more time in casinos as opposed to other places, and that activity is heavily taxed? Is it in effect kind of a grab by the state government for revenues that would otherwise stay in local areas and in consumers' pockets?
Oh, I couldn't agree more with you. I've often called gambling the painless tax. In other words, people don't realize the taxes they're paying on it. The tax rate it does vary, but from a high in Illinois of 51%, which is why, ironically, the neighboring state, Indiana, has a much lower tax. And so they've actually opened up more casinos than Illinois. But clearly, I mean, your point is well taken. Gambling is highly taxed, it's highly regulated, and well, it should be, but I don't think consumers realize how much money they are giving to the state. But the one thing is, they seem happy to give the money to the state. By the way, Thomas Jefferson always thought that the lottery was the best form of taxation.
Is that right?
Yes, he did.
And was there a lottery in Virginia in the 18th century?
Well, ironically, Thomas Jefferson was a great man in lots of different ways, but he was a horrendous business person. So Virginia allowed him to operate a lottery to pay off his debts. And luckily, the lottery just finished before he died. And so he died just about breaking even, but it was a lottery that he ran to help him break him even.
Huh. Now, when Pennsylvania was debating whether it would legalize casino gambling, and this is a debate that went on for many, many, many years, I was always skeptical of the arguments of new revenue and new jobs because it would probably displace, other forms of economic activity. But there was one argument that did seem compelling, and that was the fact that at the time, thousands and thousands of Pennsylvania residents were streaming into Atlantic City, New Jersey to gamble, and that's entertainment spending that was lost to Pennsylvania that was gained by New Jersey. And to what extent are states around the country expanding gambling to recapture revenue that they've been losing to neighboring states that already had it?
I would probably say that is the primary reason why states now legalize gambling. So, for instance, you just mentioned Pennsylvania and New Jersey. In 2008, New Jersey made $4.5 billion on gambling. Pennsylvania made $1.6 billion. And in 2009, then Pennsylvania went from just having slot machines in the racetrack to opening up full-scale casinos. So just to show you the difference, New Jersey went down to $3.9 billion. Pennsylvania went up to almost $2 billion. So you had a gain in revenue in Pennsylvania of around 20%. You had a negative effect in New Jersey of around 13%. So clearly, Pennsylvania declared war on New Jersey. They also declared war on Delaware, by the way. Delaware had racetracks. And so it's an arms race, by the way, about who is going to outdo. Oh, that's exactly the argument Ohio just approved in the last election. And the reason why Ohio approved it was because it's surrounded by states now. Everybody except Kentucky has casino gambling in it.
All right, so are we approaching a kind of detente in which every state has all kinds of gambling and nobody's stealing revenue from anybody else, but nobody's really any better off?
Well, that's an interesting point. Right now, there's 40 states that have some type of gambling. So, for instance, while Hawaii never has to worry about it, Hawaii is sitting out there by itself. But yeah, there's various ways states declare war on other states for gambling. California basically cut a deal with all its tribes. They will let them open up a series of Native American casinos all over the state of California. And then California got 25% of the revenue from the slot machines. And clearly California was declaring war on Nevada. And it's hurt Nevada. There's no doubt it's hurt Nevada. And you see this in state after state after state. I'm in the state right now, Massachusetts. The argument in the legislature that's going to win the day is the fact that one-third of the patrons in the two Native American casinos in Connecticut are from Massachusetts. And that's why Massachusetts, I mean, right now, once again, the Speaker of the House of Massachusetts says we have to revisit this issue. And he and the governor have arguments about it's not about having casino gambling. It's where to have it and what, how much to have. So the argument isn't about having casino gambling. It's this where and when.
You know, when you and I spoke before, you said you sometimes think states get more addicted to gambling than problem gamblers do. And I'm wondering, in states that got in early and found that there was money to be made by having this unique form of entertainment to offer, and now that others have caught up, what's been the impact on those states? Has that put them in more budget trouble than they would otherwise have been in?
Well, again, not to pick on New Jersey, but New Jersey right now is immediately talking about, okay, we have to revisit sports gambling. In other words, they're going to up the pun here. They're going to up the ante on gambling.
So they don't allow sports betting now, but they—
Right now they do not, but they will say, okay, to make the Atlantic City casinos more attractive, we will start sports gambling there. Clearly, the two Native American casinos in Connecticut, I'm sure they are thinking about sports gambling. So that's another whole area that nobody wants to touch right now, but clearly they're going to have to touch it. The internet gambling issue and the sports gambling are the two hot button issues that haven't been touched yet. But I think Dave, you've hit it right on the head. States, in order to make up the revenue they're losing to other states, they are going to up the ante. They're going to put other additional forms of gambling in their casinos.
You know, we've talked about issues of job creation and tax revenues, but there are also other downsides to gambling. Generally speaking, what are its drawbacks?
I would say the two major drawbacks are the compulsive gambling issue, which would mean the families would probably suffer from a higher divorce rate. Their personal bankruptcies would go up, and even this crime might go up. And then the other would be the cannibalization of local businesses. If a casino opens with a couple of nice restaurants in it and with a hotel, you could very well negatively impact the restaurants around where the casino is going to be located at, and even the local hotels and motels who were hoping that more people would stay at those hotels and motels because the casino were there, won't, because they'll stay at the casino.
Has that been a phenomenon people have reported? Hospitality industry folks that are excited and then disappointed?
I would say, for instance, in the two Native American casinos around Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun, that certainly has been the case. It's hurt the restaurants in those areas, and the hotels and motels in those areas are not doing well at all.
Yeah, and that's Connecticut, right? Yeah.
That's Connecticut.
Let's talk about some of the kind of issues of principle and morality that enter the debate here. In Pennsylvania, where I live, if you play the number in the lottery, it pays 500 to 1 if you win. But the odds of hitting the number are 1,000 to 1 against you. And I've always just found it appalling that the state government spends a lot of money to put cute ads on television with groundhogs and chipmunks and whatever, encouraging people to bet their hard-earned money on this game. Am I alone here? I mean, should government be really – it's one thing for government to permit gambling. Should they be encouraging it?
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I've advocated for many, many years now that the state should put the odds of the winning right next to where all the machines are being sold. They should also have to put out the percentage of winning that they get back to the bettors. So, for instance, there is no doubt about it that the lottery is certainly for the mathematically illiterate. I mean, you cannot win. For instance, the daily number is by far the worst bet you can make. Some of the instant tickets might pay back maybe 60 to 70 or 80%. By the way, the worst casino game plays back around 90%. All right, so it's not to advocate that casinos are fairer than the state governments and lotteries, but clearly the lottery is something that the state's trying to make you feel good by making a bad bet, because you're going to be giving it to a good cause. Now, that has been an American institution for a long, long, long time. If I took you to Harvard Square, every building in Harvard Yard, by the way, was built through a lottery where the Harvard University went to the state of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and said, please let us run a lottery to pay this for this building. And again, they were 50-50 payoffs. So, I mean, there's a long American tradition to use lotteries to pay for things. But I do think the state should be a lot more honest about what it's paying back. And yeah, for instance, New York uses, if you don't play, you can't win. Well, I may also say, if you can't, if you don't play, your odds are better keeping much better. And so, yeah, we use all kinds of QT. In Massachusetts, for instance, the lottery shows the new fire engine that the town bought because of the lottery. So you're supposed to feel good for being ripped off.
Right. Now, there's an argument that state-sanctioned gambling displaces criminal gambling, that, you know, the mob used to run the lottery, the state comes in, now it's clean, it's taxed, it's regulated, it's honest, you know, at least it you know, the number isn't fixed, and thereby that, you know, diminishes the power of criminals and collects taxes on the winnings. What about that?
There's a bit of truth to it. When Massachusetts first opened its daily number games, the state police went to the North End and raided the bookies in the North End. Found out how the bookies set up their number game. The state made sure that it paid a little better than the local bookies. But it's an interesting argument to use that you put. I mean, and by the way, that same argument is now being used to legalize sports gambling, saying it's right now it's a huge industry. The mob's making the money from it. Why not just legalize it and have the state use it?
It sounds as if you're saying that the research generally shows not an enormous benefit in terms of jobs and economic activity from gambling, and there are some troubling social impacts. But I know from our conversations you've said you're not a prohibitionist. I don't know. If I'm the governor and you're advising me on this issue, where do you come down? What's your bottom line?
My bottom line would be if you think you need the revenue that badly, okay, but make sure you provide for those who are going to be negatively impacted. In other words, especially make sure you provide enough revenue for those who are going to be addicted, for the compulsive gambling commissions in your state. Make sure that the local communities are going to be reimbursed, because local communities, really, all of a sudden their traffic doubles, their use of emergency equipment doubles or triples, and so they have to be reimbursed. But again, when I say absolutely no. It's how make sure you regulate it well, make sure that people are aware of the dangers of gambling. But would I say absolutely no to it? No.
I guess I should ask, are you a betting man? Do you enjoy gambling at all?
Not at all. basically, I don't like playing a game where I know I have to lose in the long run. Now, do I think is it the legitimate form of entertainment? Yes, I do. But no, I do not particularly like to gamble at all.
I'm sure you've gone into a casino just as a researcher.
Oh, many times. And I'm overwhelmed by the noise. I can see where people get fascinated by it. I don't particularly like smelling all the smoke in lots of casinos. But this thing, all of your senses. I mean, there's the drinking, the smoke, the bells, the whistles. It's a bit overwhelming, I think. But again, lots of people really, really enjoy it. And so, you know, I'd sit there and say, it's not for me. It might be for them.
Yeah, and I think you said your dad likes to take a trip to the casinos.
Oh, sure. My father probably goes down once a month. Now, there's 40 elderly people on a bus go down there. They go down there at 8:30 in the morning, get down to Atlantic City by around 10. They have their breakfast or brunch, play till around 3 or 4 o'clock, hop on the bus, and they're back in the Philadelphia area around 5:30, 6 o'clock at night. And again, my father gets – that's a great day out of the house for him. I understand where it's legitimate entertainment. I always ask him how he made out, and he always just says, well, I broke even. So I always kind of chuckle, which probably means he didn't break even. But, you know, it's a day of entertainment for him.
Well, Richard McGowan, thanks so much. It's been interesting.
It's been great to be with you, Dave.
Richard McGowan spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. McGowan is an economics professor at Boston College. His latest book is The Gambling Debate. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.